Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking. Please make sure your seatbelt is securely fastened, your tray table is in an upright and locked position, and that you are ready to get weird and think different. Please prepare for takeoff. Today is Thursday. It is March the 3rd. We are back with another episode of Destination Different. I'm recording this live from vacation because the Destination Different podcast does not stop for a trip to the mountains. It does not stop for a trip to the beach. And the show must go on. So I'm recording here from Colorado, live from vacation. This still needs to happen. The show needs to still come out. I'm going to quickly, very quickly, before we get into this week's guest, plug the love letters that I want you to write me. If you've been listening to the show the last couple weeks, I've been asking, I've been begging, I've been pleading for the listeners of this show to write me a 280 character love letter. I have been entered, the Destination Different podcast has been entered in the Podcash contest. Regular average podcasters don't get sponsorship money. It just doesn't happen. And Podcash is actually trying to do some good and give sponsorship money to up-and-coming podcasts. I've been entered, and one of the six voting criteria from the expert panel of judges is the love letters that get written in about this show. So all I ask is you take 2 seconds out of your day, you click the link in the description of the show, and you write me a love letter. 280 characters, it'll take you 2 seconds, and it gives me a legitimate shot to win this podcast sponsorship. That's all I ask. I've been asking it for a month straight now. If you haven't done it, you probably won't do it now, but this is your last chance before the deadline closes for you to write me a love letter. So please, 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 please take 2 seconds, 280 characters, go into the description, click the link, write me a 280 character love letter. Okay. Now, this week's guest, I just adore. She is just a ball of fresh air. She is so kind, so smart, so driven and clear in her purpose, and was just a delight to talk to. So my guest on this week's show, her name is Nina Perwal, and she is the author of Let That Shit Go. She is the founder of Pure Minds, and she is just an absolute delight. And like many of us, Nina worked in the corporate world. She worked in marketing. She's a brand manager. She's rising up through the corporate ranks. And she, at one point, just decided, you know what? I don't want to work in an office anymore. I don't want to just try and climb the corporate ladder. There's more purpose for me out there. There's more that I need to do. There's lessons that I can instill in other people. So she packed up her things. She went with her partner, her mom, and herself, and they headed to an ashram in Northern California. And so for an entire year, she was phoneless, computerless, completely off the grid, learning about mindfulness and meditation and ancient wisdom. And after that year, she returned home and realized, you know what, the corporate world will always be there for me. The office job will always be there for me, but there's more that I need to do. And so she started teaching mindfulness seminars, which led to her writing a book, which led to her starting her own business. And we get into all of that and more on this week's episode. And I am just so, so, so thankful to have had the chance to sit down and chat with Nina. She is a gem of a human. So kind, such a just great perspective on life. And I think you are absolutely going to love this interview with her. So without further ado, I present to you Nina Perwal, the author of Let That Shit Go, the founder of Pure Minds, and the guest on this week's Destination Different. I hope you enjoy. I'm sure this is exactly where you thought this interview would start. What
is your favorite Cadbury product?
Wow, so many to choose from, especially because for many of my corporate years, my drawers were not filled with files. They were filled with chocolate. Oh, that's a tough one. I would have to go with just their milk chocolate. It's so good. Just their
classic.
Classic milk chocolate bar.
All right. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I had to ask, obviously, because I know, you know, you worked at Cadbury Mondelez for years and had a very similar kind of day job to what I'm doing now. So I'm always curious, like taking a step back in time, like, you know, what attracted you to the corporate world and what, you know, what did you enjoy about your career in marketing and sales and what you were doing in that world?
Oh, I absolutely loved it. And it was just, I always wanted to go to business school. It was something inherent in me in high school. I wanted to learn about business. I loved marketing. I loved advertising. And I'd say the highlights of my career at Cadbury were the times in marketing where I got to be on really cool commercial shoot sets. So I've got to go to Thailand. I got to go to Ghana, Africa, when we launched Fairtrade Chocolate. I was on the global team. Those were probably the highlights. And then I was such an advocate at the time for corporate social responsibility. That's why I was put on the Fair Trade launch as well. So the opportunity that I got with Cadbury, they were a very values-driven company when I worked for them prior to the Kraft acquisition. Just the opportunity to give back and to be on some of those strategic teams were very fulfilling. The culture at Cadbury at the time was incredible. And a lot of my clients now actually are my old colleagues from Cadbury.
It's too funny. And what about, obviously there's a lot of things that you liked, but what about, you know, working in sort of the corporate world started to push you in a direction of like, hey, I gotta get out of this. I'm too stressed, or I want to go do my own thing. You know, what pieces of that, you know, started to steer you in the direction of creativity and entrepreneurship?
Yeah, I think secondarily was just the stress I was under. I had a pretty big portfolio I was managing. I was addicted to my BlackBerry or CrackBerry. They called it, I'm dating myself, but, you know, checking email all hours of the night, just completely consumed by work, which, you know, was a lot of my own fault in my 20s because I didn't know how to handle stress well. I was always in my own head. So I think, you know, it would be different now, but it was stress. And then primarily was just this longing for wanting to spread ancient wisdom. That's always been a part of me. I was always that person in corporate who had positive quotes all over their desks and, you know, spreading positive messages. And so that had always been an inherent part of me. And I think 5 years ago when I started my business, people were just starting to talk about mindfulness and wellness and mental health. And then the pandemic came along and everyone's talking about mental health now. But at the time I was like, there is something here where I would love to go into corporate now and help the old me, help the people who are really stressed out and having a hard time with the, you know, the fast-paced environment or the stress that comes with the job or, you know, how to balance tech. Like there's so many different elements right now. And so that was primarily why I left corporate and started my business. It was more just an internal passion. And when I studied in California, one of the monks said to me, and this really resonated, he said, as long as you're walking a path that's not meant for you, you're going to feel like you're walking with a little rock in your shoe. And I realized in that moment, I loved what I did, you know, but I was walking with a little rock in my shoe. So how do I take it out? I still do work in corporate, but I do what I love.
Okay. For the listeners who don't know, your little, you know, rendezvous to Northern California. Tell me about that. So you, what was there like a final breaking point that you said, hey, I gotta get out of here. I'm quitting my job. I'm going out to a monastery in Northern California. I'm going to take a year sabbatical. Was there a moment? And then what did you sort of get into as you went on that sabbatical?
Yeah. So it was a moment combined with the opportunity that this 1 year course came up. And I just remember driving into work. I had an hour long commute and something in my gut was like, you gotta go. You got to go. So I actually went with my partner and my mom was there actually. So it was an incredible experience. But once we got there, you know, we completely unplugged. So I went from being highly addicted to my CrackBerry to completely unplugged and, you know, learning all of this ancient wisdom. And it was as enlightening as it was challenging because a lot of this is happening for people in the pandemic. When there's quiet, when there's lockdown, when, you know, things are shut down, shit comes up for you. And stuff I was suppressing for a really, really long time ended up coming up in that year. I had to move through a lot while learning all of this incredible ancient wisdom. And then I came back, and this was in 2011. So still people weren't into mindfulness, meditation. Yoga was a thing, but nothing else. And so I thought, what the heck am I going to do with this? And I went back into corporate, but I worked in startup. And working in startup was incredible for me to learn, to step into entrepreneurship. You know, going from big corporate to startup to entrepreneurship was a really great kind of segue into where I am now, because I learned how to just do things from the ground up. A few years after startup, I was like, okay, I think I'm ready. I feel like the world's ready. And I gave myself a year. I said, I had two clients at the time, and I said, I'm going to give myself a year. And if things don't work out, I'll go back. Like, I always have corporate to default to. For all the people who are wondering whether they should pursue their side hustle or leave, and you always have your job to or corporate to fall back on if things don't work out. And here we are 5 years later, I've got over 45 clients. I just love, love, love what I do. But that 1 year is what, you know, catapulted me and enabled me, gave me the permission to do what I do now. Yeah.
All right. I want to stay on that 1 year for a little bit. So was your partner and your mom both in this program as well? Was it like the three of you just like going through monk school? Like,
yeah, 100% was.
How was that experience sharing that with the two of them?
You know, it was incredible. My partner and I learned so much about each other that year. We always say if we didn't learn anything about ancient wisdom, it was like huge for our relationship. My mom actually worked for corporate for, you know, she was working for a bank, a really well-known bank for 24 years. She had one more year to all of her retirement, and this course came up, and she lived in the moment. And she said, no, I'm going to the course, then I'm going to work my last year. And thank God, because when we came back, within months, she was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's or ALS, and, you know, passed away 2 years to her diagnosis. But I always think about that. I think about, what if she just spent that one last year working, you know, but instead she spent her last healthy year in this magical, you know, ashram and learning about ancient wisdom with her daughter and her son-in-law. So I think, you know, being there with them, of course there were challenging moments because you're in close quarters all the time, going to class together. It's like you're back in school. But it was incredible because it felt just less isolating, and you had people to talk. You had your closest people, you know, your tribe that you could talk to and reflect with. But it was serious school. We had to get up every day. There were no weekends. We had to get up at like 5:30 for meditation. And then we had classes all day, starting at 7 in the morning. We had, you know, tests, and we had to give presentations, and, you know, it was legit. We studied some crazy, incredible, texts, and it's just a year. It was a pivotal year in my life for sure.
Yeah. I'm sure that's a special memory for a lot of reasons. When you say you're there studying and you're taking classes and your courses, like, explain that to me, like I'm a 5-year-old, and like, what does that sort of look like in a monastery learning from monks, studying ancient wisdom? Like, I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around what that looks like. So explain that a little bit.
Yeah. So, I'm going to get into a little bit of, ancient wisdom and a little bit of religion here, but before, you know, Hinduism was invented, or not, like came to be, were, these texts that were written that is just pure knowledge, before there were, you know, idols and gods and goddesses. And there's many of them. There are different names for them. But we studied all of these different texts, and each monk would come in for a month or so and teach us a few. And we would have, you know, like I said, classes all day, take notes, you know, be able to talk with them, have Q&As, discussions. And they were all texts that went back to the big life questions. What's my purpose? Who am I? You know, what is life all about? And you talked about things like consciousness and connectivity and oneness. It was just, sorry, this is not a 5-year-old explanation.
That's all right.
At the end of the day, what ancient wisdom talks about is that our true nature is actually happiness and joy and love and bliss and all of these wonderful things. And so when people say, oh, I'm on a journey to find happiness, or I'm on a mission, I always tell people it's already there. It's already who you are. When we were born, we were inherently happy. We just built all this shit in the way that we have to recognize, be aware of, and then kind of move out of the way. So it just kept going back. The teaching kept going back to, you know, you are that, you know, light and wisdom, and that's already within you. So it's just about kind of going back and finding that. And it was just incredible.
Okay. I'm understanding, I think, a little bit better here now. So, as part of that, you know, you have the study of the ancient wisdom, and you're also, you know, practicing meditation on a daily basis, and you're doing that. And it's something that clearly was like an interest of yours. You mentioned, you know, you have quotes up on your desk and things like that. So it's always been something that's part of you. As you came back, you know, from that retreat, and you re-entered the corporate world, was your thought, okay, I need to start something with this. There's something that I need to build that's beyond, you know, what I'm doing in the corporate world. So what was that process like of actually going from like inception of idea to execution of launching Pure Minds, of writing your book? Like how did that transition start to happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I always inherently knew that I liked corporate and I loved what I did, but there was something more for me. And listen to your gut, listen to your intuition. It tells you, it's always coming and knocking, you know, so listen to that. And I finally got to a point where, like I said, I felt companies were in a good place with it. You know, you have to financially plan as well. When you leave corporate, you know, you're making some good dough, and suddenly you're going from this to zero. So, you know, I had many conversations with my partner, or, you know, financially plan ahead, lots of savings. And then when I felt, you know, practically, spiritually, emotionally, mentally ready, that in combination with losing my mom, I think, you know, I hit a point of like, tomorrow's not guaranteed. You know, tomorrow is not guaranteed. I was 4 months pregnant when she died. And, you know, we have a year maternity leave in Canada. I was going to go back to work. And I thought, no, I'm not doing it. I'm not going back to work. I life is so fleeting. Now's the time. So it was a little bit of practicality, a little bit of that, you know, emotional push. And, you know, I jumped in. My co-author and I started doing workshops in the city of Toronto, and they went viral. We labeled them, you know, put swear words on them. That was her idea to do workshops called Mindful as Fuck, and, you know, learn how to fucking meditate. And suddenly people are like, okay, I don't have to go to a temple, or this sounds really approachable. And that's what I wanted. I wanted people to feel like, you know, mindfulness and meditation is for everyone. You know, people find it intimidating, but it's anyone can do it. You just need to learn the tools and the skills. So we started doing that in Toronto. And then before you know it, they went corporate. And our publisher, HarperCollins, actually discovered us and loved how we were pitching mindfulness and meditation and talking about it, and asked us to write the book, Let That Shit Go. So it's been an incredible journey, but it's one of those things where when you follow your heart and your gut and your intuition, this might sound a little cheesy, but the universe supports you. Like you end up being supported. There might be some bumps and, you know, hiccups along the way, but you will be supported when you do what you love, because it's just what you're in. We're all here for a purpose. We're all here for a reason. And when we find that and pursue that, that's when the magic happens.
First of all, a year maternity leave. Canada's doing it right. Like that is like,
it's 18 months now. 18 months. I know. And I have such a issue with that in the US that I could do a whole podcast on that.
Yeah. That is brilliant. That makes perfect sense. And it's great that that was sort of, you know, one of the factors that pushed you to be like, no, I'm not going back to work. I'm starting to do my own thing. Go ahead.
You have the year to think, right?
Yeah.
You don't have time in the US. You just got to get right back into it.
But right.
There's reflection time. I think that helped for sure.
Yeah. As you started doing the workshops in Toronto, and your now co-author, you know, partner, I guess, like, was there, you know, obviously you're putting the swear words on, you know, hey, this is mindful as fuck. Like I love that. And even within the book, you know, the language is so approachable. You talk about negative Nancy's and you're inner asshole. And there's like all these things that are like, very easily to the point of explain it like I'm five. Like they do make it just very easy to understand. Was that a strategic thought as you went into this of like, we got to make this, we got to dumb it down. We got to make this simple for the everyday person.
1,000%. And the swearing, you know, it did scare me because I learned from these, all these incredible monks and I'm like, what are they going to say? But then I had a potty mouth because I spent time in sales, you know, not to generalize people in sales, but I had this huge potty mouth. And so I'm like, this is me. This is, and I almost walked away because I was so nervous about, you know, combining ancient wisdom with swearing. But then I realized, you know, this is who I am and people are going to, you know, take it or leave it. This is how I'm showing up. That was a really empowering move. But yes, a lot of that was, you know, the tip based, where there's 120 tips in the book, was intentional to, you know, make people feel like, again, mindfulness and meditation is accessible. It was actually our publisher's recommendation to not even use the word mindfulness until the last, like the second last chapter is mindfulness, the last chapter is meditation, because their thoughts, editor's thoughts were, and at first we pushed back. We're like, no, it's a whole book on mindfulness. We're not doing that. And then they said, you know, and this was in 2018, right? Mm-hmm. So people weren't really into mindfulness yet. They said, it's too intimidating. People are exhausted. They're going to feel like I have to learn another thing. So we very strategically wrote the book, you know, with all these mindfulness tips. And then at the end said, you just climbed this mountain, and this mountain you climbed and this massive thing you learned is mindfulness. It's that simple. You know, so yes, the tip base is very intentional. It's one of those books where you can keep on your nightstand and just pull up, open a page and pull open a tip and like try to apply that tip for the week. It's great if you read it chronologically, but you don't need to. It's one of those books where you can just grab tips. And we wanted to make it, you know, the biggest thing for me was making ancient wisdom practical, because there are lots of amazing self-help books out there. With incredible knowledge and wisdom, but I came from corporate. I worked through all that stress. And so my whole intention was, well, how do I talk to this group of people or just anyone in general going through stress and anxiety and worry, trying to find their happiness, and make it super, super practical on how they can apply it in the everyday.
It's interesting. I haven't heard, maybe this happens more than I just don't, I'm not aware of it, but that the publisher found you and was like, hey, there's a book here. There's something within this. So what was that creative process like for you of writing the book? How long was it from them finding you to actually like, you know, book hitting shelves? And what did that look like for you and your co-author writing it, rewriting it, changing things? Like how was that for you as a creative and as somebody who has never authored a book before?
Yeah, I never had intentions to write a book because people are like, oh, that's so amazing, such a goal. And I said, I never had goals to write a book. And this is what I mean by when you follow your heart, the universe, suddenly things started to fall in my lap. No word of a lie. So super, super blessed and grateful, because that rarely happens, that the publisher, and a big publisher too, found us. On the flip side, they found us. You know, we had a little bit of push and pull because they wanted to call the book Fuck Meditation. And we're like, no, we're not. And so we walked away and then we ended up coming back. And once we agreed, we wrote a proposal, they loved it. And the proposal had all the tips kind of laid out in the chapters. And then, you know, once we agreed, they're like, okay, hold hands for a minute, sit down. And they're like, you have 9 weeks to write the book. And this is the, you know, these are the challenging things. And you go with the big
publisher. The stress starts to creep back in there again.
And we're like, this is counterintuitive to what we're trying to teach. But we had 9 weeks to write it. We had to submit a chapter a week. Crazily enough, everything in that book, it was kind of like a love story to ourselves, from ourselves. I mean, everything in that book are things I had been contemplating for 20 years. So it all came out very naturally, even though we had 9 weeks to write. And we used Google Docs. Kate and I probably saw each other twice the entire process, because I live in the boonies, she lives in the city. So we just use Google Docs, we check in. And then after that, we had a 4-month editing process where we had about 4 editors, pretty grueling process. They approached us in March of 2018 and the book launched in January of 2019. So it was, and typically you're supposed to hand in a full manuscript a year before the launch. So we were on an incredibly tight timeline. It was just the timing of everything. Like people were starting to talk about mindfulness and, you know, they really, really wanted a January launch, because January is like new year, new you. So the timeline was tight, but it was an incredible process. And for me, it felt quite seamless, because again, it was all, everything I've been contemplating that just kind of came through me.
And were you like a growing up a serial note taker? Like, it was some of this already documented in a way, or was this like totally just coming stream, you know, from your brain?
Totally through me. Like, no, not a serial note taker. You know, I went through some trauma, childhood, really intense teenage trauma. And so, you know, I went from a straight A student to like really having a hard time at school. And I tell high school students now that I speak to, you know, I failed grade 12 English. Like, I failed English and somehow I'm a best-selling author. So, you know, never give up. But no, I was never a note taker. Again, I had no intentions to write a book. I was never a strong English student. I was more like a math and numbers person. But you know, as soon as I, like, again, when you do what you're meant to do, things come very naturally. You're in a state of flow more often because you're not, it's like, you're not trying, you're just kind of listening, if you will.
And you, it's a unique scenario too, where you had a co-author on this. It wasn't just you, you were working with Kate. So tell me a little bit about Kate. And from my understanding, you two used to work together. She worked for you, and then you now teamed up to write this book. So tell me about that kind of collaborative process.
You've done your research, Mr.
I do a thorough internet stalking. I know way more about you than I should probably, but.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So when I worked in startup, I was the GM for Canada for this global company. And I hired Kate to run marketing. And we sat across from each other and she just started getting into ancient wisdom. And I knew I had already been, you know, 15 years of my journey. And she's like, you need to write about this. You need to be an advocate for ancient wisdom. And she would ask me all these questions. We sat across from each other. And then, you know, I went on mat leave and, you know, she left the company. And then, you know, we hooked up a few years later and she said, she's the one who launched her company Mind Matters. And she said, I'm doing workshops in Toronto for all of these different things, but I have a few on mindfulness and meditation. Would you teach them? And I was like, absolutely. You know, wasn't making much, but I'm like, yeah, sure. Like I would, you know, it's a dream come true for me to do this. And so Harper Collins found us from there. And it was seamless doing the book with her because, you know, had worked together for 4 or 5 years. It was a very loving process. There was no judgment. There was no anger. There was no, it has to be this way. Like when we wrote and gave each other feedback, it was received like with an open heart. So it was a very seamless process. She's now kind of left the Let That Shit Go platform. She really is, she's such an environmental advocate. So she is doing stuff with climate justice and whatnot. We're still, you know, very close, but the process was fantastic. And if you do write a co-author a book with someone, you know, you want to make sure it's someone you inherently love and trust. And I know that's so cheesy, but you know, it's so important because it's like your innermost soul and your innermost work coming out, and you want to make sure that it's received with just love and no judgment. So it was a seamless process with Kate.
All right. I just, you know, I wanted to check. I'm like, oh, former coworkers. I'm like, are there any coworkers that I'd write a book with? Like, I don't know. and as the book launched, it was, you know, highly successful. So I'm curious for you as somebody who worked in, you know, you worked in marketing. There's obviously a lot of marketing that then goes into launching a book. There's the press tour, there's the social media, there's all of the stuff that comes with trying to then get people to read the book. So how was that for you? And what was sort of your approach to actually, you know, getting this book out there and getting people to read it?
Yeah, a big part of getting it out there was the help of having a big publisher. So a lot of people ask me about self-publish versus publisher. And when you have a publisher, they have all the contacts with retail. Right? So they get your book into Barnes & Noble, into Books A Million, in Canada it's Indigo. And then they also arranged a massive press tour for the first 2 weeks. So we launched in Canada. So we got on every single morning show, you know, talk show in Canada. But because we were from Canada, no US publisher would take us because A, we were Canadian, B, self-help was saturated. And C, we didn't have a platform. We weren't famous. Like, it's really hard to get on a bestseller list unless you're famous and already have a platform. So after the first two initial weeks of press, they kind of were like, okay, you're on your own, you know, start your little Instagram account. So it's been a lot of hustle, you know, finding influencers to post about the book. Like in Canada, it did amazing. And then it took us 3 years. Finally, a US publisher recognized the success we had in Canada. I mean, we launched globally. We launched in the UK, we launched in Australia, we launched in Africa, tons of European countries, but the US is where you have good scale, right? So finally, after 3 years, this is why I say never give up, a US publisher picked us up. And now, I mean, a few weeks ago, we were the number one self-help book in US airports. We were like, we're on NCAPS at Barnes and Noble. And again, that is a lot of the publishers push because they have these retail, and that's really hard when you're self-published to have a relationship with Barnes and Noble and get on shelf is a really tough thing. So, you know, what I would say, yes, it was success in Canada off the bat, but there's still, like, I still post about my book. I still repost. I'm still waiting for like a Justin Bieber or like a Kim Kardashian to post about it, because then I can get on to New York Times.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a process. But I love it. And if you love it and you believe inherently in everything you've written about, it comes very naturally. But I, you know, it's not this like instantaneous success. I think with books, unless you're famous and you already have a massive platform and it's like, oh, Priyanka Chopra wrote a book, let's all go all out and get it. You have to kind of push to get yourself out there. But it's a, you know, our work in marketing was very beneficial because Kate worked for agency side, and you know, the book cover stands out. Like it just stands out. And the saying too, like the irony of Let That Shit Go launching in the middle of the pandemic and everything going on, you know, that was incredible and worked in our favor as well. So there are a couple of marketing, you know, many times our marketing experience came into play, you know, the way we would push our publisher as well. I don't think they were used to dealing with ex marketers or business women. They were used to dealing with authors who maybe not been as aggressive. So you have to, even though you have the support of a publisher, you still have to take ownership over the book and, you know, push where you can, and, you know, for placement, for, you know, anything, you know, more press or like recognition here. So it is, it's a process and it's kind of a continuing one.
Yeah. It's crazy. 3 years that it's, you know, just now starting to hit US shelves, and it must feel for you a little bit like it's almost starting from zero again. Like you get to kind of start over in this new market and get to experience all the, you know, those highs again.
Yeah. And it's exciting. Cause like it's, you know, people are like, oh yeah, it's been a few years, you're going to write another book. And I'm like, I still think there's so much, you know, leverage in the first book. But yeah, getting into the US was, you know, such a blessing. And I just didn't think it was going to happen after a few years. I'm like, all right, I've accepted it. I mean, people could get it on Amazon, but in store is a completely different, you know, when you're actually listed here in the US, it's a completely different ballgame. So that was huge for sure.
All right. So I'll scratch my question off of, are you going to write another book?
Well, there is a little bit of talk about, yeah, there's two in the works that I can't talk about yet, but again, no intentions. I'm a businesswoman. I have to plan for the future. You know, I have to plan 1 year out, 2 years out, but at the same time, I'm also very open to, you know, bring, you know, whatever comes, I'm going to run with it. And I think that's the biggest shift with corporate to entrepreneurial life is in corporate, you have one job and you have one salary and it's like all tied up in this bow. When you go to entrepreneurship, it's like some of my income is my book. Some of my income is my corporate workshops. Some of it is my community workshops. Some of it is, you know, little fireside chats I do. I launched a kids podcast, you know, it comes from everywhere. And so going from really structured to being open to, you know, okay, whatever comes, I'm going to run with it when it feels right. That's a big mindset shift. And it's not like, okay, the book or the workshops have to bring it all in. It doesn't work that way. But you know, it's a really good learning, and that's what startup kind of taught me as well.
I pretty much ask everybody this question at this point, and you just touched on a little of kind of the pie chart of how things start to break out in terms of finances, and looking at like, you probably have 4, 5, 6, 7 different revenue streams that start coming in. So you don't have to go into exact numbers, but like percentage wise, what does it start to shake out like for you of like where, you know, where the money comes in? Cause ultimately, yes, you are creative, but you're running a business and you have a family and you need to support yourself. And so what is the financial side of, you know, being a creative entrepreneur, mindfulness coach start to look like?
Yeah. And you do have to plan, you do have to, you know, there is that practical side of things. But I'd say that a good majority right now comes from my corporate workshops. And it's a good fit for me because I can speak the language. I know what it's like to work in sales and marketing. I actually started my career in category management working at AC Nielsen. And so I can talk the talk through a lens of mindfulness. So it makes sense for me. The one thing I wish with corporate is that, you know, people had their walls down a bit. People are a little more vulnerable, and which is starting to happen with mental health. You know, and then my books are a portion, you know, I'd say about 20%. And then, like I said, I have all these kids initiatives. I started also doing one-on-ones with Boston Beer. So I do, you know, one-on-one mindfulness coaching as well. So there's a portion that comes from that. And yeah, as an entrepreneur, again, people sometimes want to find the thing. And, you know, when I coach, I tell people sometimes it's about starting out knowing what you don't want to do. You know, this job isn't right for me, or this industry isn't right for, you know, I don't think I want to do the work at a desk. I want to do something with my hand. Like sometimes it's coming from that place, and then things start to kind of fall into place. I think we have to get rid of this whole idea of like, we have to have it all figured out before we jump. We have to have a little figured out. Don't get me wrong. But if I look back to when I started my company in 2017, I look ahead, I never would have guessed. I never in a million years would have guessed the book. That's for sure. But even the kids stuff that's happening this year, I mean, I've been wanting to do kids stuff for 2 years now, and I wasn't forcing it. I was just putting it out there, and it came in such a big way. I got asked to run a podcast. I got asked to run kids meditations. So I have 40 kids meditations out there with this one app. So, you know, it's about listening to your gut, to your intuition, being a little bit practical, but not trying to anticipate. Like in corporate, we know 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, like, well, exactly what's going to happen, you know, and it pretty much goes to that plan unless there's a big kerfuffle. In entrepreneurship life, it's a little, you're kind of riding the waves, and you got to be okay with that.
As a fellow podcast host now, so tell me how has that been for you so far? Cause that is a whole nother skill set that I'm sure, you know, there's a learning curve, and not only are you hosting, but you're working with children, and that adds a whole other element that, you know, probably puts a wrinkle into things. So what has that been like, and adding another, you know, creative notch on your belt?
Yeah. Again, I didn't see this coming at all. It's with a kids company about, and they are huge with social justice. They've got about 60 books, like a kid's book about systemic racism, a kid's book about feminism, a kid's book about being transgender, like incredible topics. And so I approached them about a number of things, and they actually came back and said, you know, that the head of podcasts ended up listening to my audiobook. And he's like, I think you've got a voice for podcasting. And I'm like, really? Again, just like out of nowhere, right? And he's the producer of the show, but he's like, would you be the host? And I'm like, absolutely I would be. So they sent me all this recording equipment. I did a lot of coaching on how to talk to kids. So talking up to them is what they call it, versus like, you know, when you hear shows and they're like, that's really great. Oh my goodness. It's like none of that. It's like you talk to them like they're another human. So a lot of coaching on that. And then I have to say, they do all the production. They put all the sound. I have to just send in my recordings. I come up with the questions for the kids. I have some kids that I record with as well, and they're freaking adorable. And, you know, I'm just a conduit to these questions and these answers. I have my bits throughout, but it's the kids' knowledge and intellect that really drive the podcast. And they ask amazing questions. Like there was one about, you know, do you have to say sorry if you don't mean it? What do you do if a friend is mean to you sometimes? And, you know, I get adults saying like, I was listening with my kid, but I actually learned something.
There was a great one. It was like, what do you do if you get a present and you don't like it? And I'm like, that is brilliant. I love that.
Yeah, exactly. There's all these great questions that even adults are trying to navigate. And, you know, they're small episodes because they're for kids. They're like 10, 15 minutes, but we encourage, you know, families like pause the show now and you talk about it, you know, with your guardians or your adults, you know, what do you think? And people are actually doing that. And so the podcast has been listened to in 78 countries. already, and it's been featured by Apple and iTunes. So again, another avenue that was totally unexpected, but I absolutely love it. Like, I had no idea I had this podcast to radio voice, but apparently I do.
And I see that you're recording on the floor of your closet.
Yeah. Oh my God. You did a deep stock.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I only say that because for probably the first year and a half or so of doing this podcast, I was sitting on the floor in my closet because it's the best place to record. You got the coats hanging up. It absorbs the sound. It's like no distractions. And now I don't have a closet in my apartment that I can even remotely sit in. So it's like,
you inspire me because now you're in this big fancy room with your headphones and your mic. Look at you. So maybe that'll be in a few years.
I don't know. I think I want to go back to the closet. That was like the dream scenario.
I do. I record in my closet. Yes.
Does it give you an inkling or an itch to like want to start your own show, to be like, to kind of go down the podcast route? Like, I'm always curious as people get into more creative things like the book, you're like, well, there probably are a couple other books in me. The podcast, it's like, maybe there is, you know, does that give you any interest to start something of your own?
Yeah, a good question. I evaluate every single opportunity with, you know, my passion, you know, I have to look at, you know, is it lucrative for me versus time investment? And right now I'm at the place where, you know, if there are other books on the horizon and I'm really focusing on corporate, because that's where I feel like I can make the biggest impact. Right now with podcasts, my goal is to be interviewed on podcasts by people who already have a platform, because I have heard that to build that platform, you know, to do all the editing and, you know, the intro, outro music, all that stuff, you know, it takes a lot of work, takes a lot of learning. So right now I'm like that can wait. I'm not there. I'm happy to be interviewed. So I'd say, you know, I probably get interviewed a few times a month for podcasts, and it's a great way for, you know, to drive awareness on my book. But I think podcast wise, for now, I'm not ready to start my own. I don't know if I ever will be, but I like, you know, being interviewed for people who already have an established platform. I find like that's probably the most efficient space for me to be in right now.
I can't confirm the editing and the music. It is a pain in the ass.
Right. I don't do that with my own podcast. The company does it for me, and it's a lot. Like, I have a lot of friends who do, you know, have podcasts, and I hear how hard, and, you know, you're already a few years in, which is a huge bonus. I think a lot of people started podcasts in the pandemic. Mm-hmm. You know, so they're on episode 5 now, and it's just like, I don't want to start that from scratch. Like, you know, and you're already so established. So I think that's, you know, that's great that you've been here for so long. That's a huge advantage.
As you look more broadly at the future, and I know you've talked about, like, you know, I take things as they come, and some of these things just appear based on, you know, kind of what you're already working on. Do you set out for yourself, hey, in 3 years, I want Pure Minds to be doing this, or I want to be hiring a team to be helping me with this? Like, do you start to map out any of those future business visions?
Yeah, definitely I do. And I think it's, again, inherent because I worked in corporate for so long and did brand plans and, you know, looked at P&Ls and did plan, you know, 2, 5, 10 years ahead. And it's an important aspect, you know, of an entrepreneur life and making sure that you can sustain yourself. So I plan loosely, but the key, and this is also part of the ancient wisdom, is I'm not attached to that plan. You know, like 2 years ago, I approached HarperCollins to do a kid's book and I got rejected. So I thought, okay, now is not the time for me, but I still put it out there. I'm like, how do I work with kids? How do I work? And then I came across this company, a kids company, wrote them in March. They didn't even give me the time of day until like September or something. So I thought that was another ship sailed. So I plan. So yeah, I would love to have a team. I would love to break down barriers in corporate. I would love to do more community stuff. So I have a sense, you know, I'd love to write, you know, have these books come out. But I'm not attached. Like, even this book I'm loosely working on, you know, again, I'm doing it with someone, and we're both like, okay, if it happens in 2 years or it happens in 5 years or 7 years, that's okay. You know, so there is the practicality, right? So it's like, right now corporate is the main source of my income, so I got to keep chugging along with that. But yeah, loosely, like 3, 4 years from now, I want it to look like this. I would love to let that shit go, to just, you know, completely flourish in the US. It's doing really, really well, but like, to a point where, you know, I'm getting more income from the book, which means I can invest, like the more income I get, the more I can invest in things like starting a podcast right. and things that aren't lucrative in the beginning. Right. So yeah, I loosely plan, but another thing I tell entrepreneurs is plan, but don't be attached to that plan. And I actually posted this. I love this quote. I don't know. It's unknown. Don't know who wrote it. But it says, write your passion in pen and your path in pencil. And I love that because it's like, know what you want to do inherently. You know, my goal is to spread ancient wisdom. That's what I want to do. How that manifests, you know, again, is I have goals and I have ambitions, but it can go a million different ways. And, you know, being open to that is huge. Not having to be like, it has to look like this. Being open to all the different ways that it can manifest and you can put it out there is part of the process for me, for sure.
Okay. That's the long-term, you know, look ahead. On the kind of day-to-day, how do you sort of manage your schedule, your time, prioritizing what you're working on? What does it start to shake out like for you on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis?
Yeah, I tell my, you know, the people I coach this as well is, you know, every day I kind of have a to-do list in my head. So I know, you know, today I'm going to have a podcast interview with Ryan. I got to finish that one deck. I got to, you know, apply for this thing. I got to write a proposal. So I have loosely, you know, what I'm going to do for the day. Days I have big corporate workshops, I don't book anything else because like, it's like writing an exam for me. Every time I have a corporate workshop, that's all I can focus on. And then by the end, I'm just like, you know, like it takes a lot out of me.
Yeah.
So, you know, weeks that I have big corporate workshops, I try to keep light as well. So I kind of know my schedule ahead of time. There's also the business development component too, where I'm, you know, reaching out to leaders, although again, a lot of them are my ex-colleagues. A lot of my business now has come from recommendation, which I'm so, so, so grateful for. The first few years were like hustle, 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 like reach out to your ex-network and on LinkedIn and post and da, da, da. And now I think I've got enough clients where it's like, I'm going deep with companies. But yeah, the day-to-day is, you know, I try to set goals for myself every single day. And I know what I need to get done. I need to finish up my taxes today too. And we're talking about that offline. And then, you know, that's the way I don't get overwhelmed. Cause it's like, I know I have a massive presentation next week, but you know, I'm not going to think about it till Monday. That's when I'm going to finish the deck. And that's what I'm going to, so again, that's where mindfulness comes in for me, is like just trying to be really intentional and compartmentalize each day. So I'm not like feeling overwhelmed about, you know, the next week or the next month ahead.
We haven't got to touch on it too much, but I want to quickly just speak to meditation. You know, we talked a lot about, you know, mindfulness and how you make space, but what is your, I think meditation, I know for me, it's, you know, kind of an intimidating thing. I think for a lot of people, it can be sort of an intimidating thing. So what does your practice look like? And what would be just some basic things that you would kind of recommend to somebody who's looking to maybe take a breath, chill out, clear their head in the day-to-day?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I always say meditation is such a personal practice. My meditation teacher said, I can't teach you meditation, but I can guide you, because everyone's practice is, you know, it's their own personal practice. And so I like to start with meditation myths. And, you know, the biggest thing I talk about is don't expect your thoughts to stop. You know, I've been meditating for 17 years now. I've never had a meditation where one or two or 100 or 1,000 thoughts have not come through. It's the mind's job to think thoughts. So people who are intimidated by it think you have to sit in silence and then suddenly your mind goes quiet. Doesn't work that way. In fact, the opposite happens sometimes, because finally you're not distracted by TV and work and meetings and cooking and laundry. And suddenly it's like, shit's coming up because you're sitting there quiet, you know? So you also learn a lot about yourself. So I would say, you know, the first thing is don't expect your thoughts to stop. The second is like, think of it like going to the gym for your mind. You know, like we take so much care, the media, society puts so much emphasis on the body, what we look like, our hair, our makeup, what we wear, our bodies, working out, eating healthy, wellness. But how much time are we spending on our minds? Like, and that's where we are all the time, right? So it's like meditation is like going to the gym for your mind. And I also say, you know, start small, like start with 30 seconds for a week, and then the next week go up to 1 minute, and then the next week go up to 2 minutes, and lean into practices that work for you. If you want to sit there in silence and just focus on breath, That's great. If you need, if your mind needs something to hold on to, like an app, then download Headspace or Calm. And if one doesn't work, try another. There are a million YouTube videos on different meditations. If you want a nature sounds, or if you want a guided meditation, you know, the ones I have for kids, there's meditations on, I am sad, I am angry, I'm sitting on a beach, you know, unplugging from technology. They're very practical ones too, right? So you can find a meditation that works for you. And that's the most important thing is, yes, it might feel intimidating at first, but trust the process. And it's like when you start going to the gym, like you're not going to have a six pack the next day, right? But after a while, I mean, neurologists and neuroscientists have studied MRI scans of the brain and have seen in as little as 8 weeks, there's massive structural changes. Your amygdala, which is associated with fight or flight, stress, anxiety, starts to shrink. And simultaneously, your prefrontal cortex thickens. And that's associated with concentration, decision-making, awareness. So, you know, it works. And it doesn't just impact you in meditation. There's this trickle effect to your life outside of meditation. You start to become a better, more calm version of yourself, less reactive. And so for me, a big thing too is don't judge your practice. Couldn't meditate this morning, trying to get kids off to school and do, you know, like, okay, that's fine. Don't beat yourself. Okay, you couldn't get it done today. But I try to meditate every morning. One of the monks I learned under said, meditate before you enter the world. And what he meant by that was before you check your phone, before you talk to someone, before your head goes into that meeting or this project or a million different things, just meditate. So actually I've gotten to the habit recently where I just sit up in bed as soon as I get up, even if it's for 2 minutes. I mean, I would love it for it to be half an hour. And sometimes it is, and just meditate, just take a few deep breaths. So my practice is, again, very personal and very different. And I go through phases. Sometimes I'm into just breathing. Sometimes I'm into chakra healing. Sometimes I'm into, you know, listening to nature sounds. So really, again, lean into self and lean into intuition and gut for the practice, but anyone can do it.
All right. I've been trying my best. I, you know, we talked about this a few weeks ago. I do my breathing. Like that's sort of what I've been trying to work on is like, even if it's just in between meetings, two breaths, three breaths, just do the quick, like just get it out, get it in. Like that's been what's worked best for me so far.
Breathing is so powerful. Breathing, Jay Shetty talks about breathing is attached to your emotion. So if you can get your deep breathing, I mean, you can immediately physiologically get yourself into a calm state.
It really is crazy how like much 10 deep breaths can do for you. Amazing. All right. So I have just a couple rapid fires I want to end you out here with.
Okay.
And we can, you know, we'll put a bow on this beautiful interview. So maybe my first one, I'll start with, we're going to play fact or fiction, or are these real or are these not real?
Okay.
Some reviews from your,
oh no.
we'll confirm. Are they from, you have to guess, are they from your book or are they not from your book?
Okay.
So the first one, pragmatic and easily digestible.
Fact. I check Amazon, okay? Like it's my book. I know for every single freaking review. Okay, let's see. Let's see if I know every review.
Okay, next one. What you need right now.
Not from our book.
From your book.
It is, okay. Yeah.
Okay, this one. What did I just read?
No, that's not from our book.
That is not from your book. That's from Catcher in the Rye. I figured, you know, we dig into the
good one,
into the reviews a little bit. All right. If you had, I like to ask people this, if you had a billboard in Times Square, you can put anything on it that you want. It can be a message. It can be an advertisement. It can be a picture. It can be anything. What would you put on your Times Square billboard?
Wow. That's a really powerful question. I would put something along the lines of, oh my God, I'm ex-marketer here trying to come up with a tagline. You know, something along the lines of that, you know, your true nature is happiness. You are that you were seeking. Because again, people, we lose sight of it. We lose sight of what we have right here within us that we can lean into anytime. And that's what mindfulness and meditation does. It helps you give access to that. So something along the lines of, you know, it's already, may the force be with you now. It's already in you. you know, something along those lines of letting people know that it's just, hence the book title, Let That Shit Go. It's just shit that's in the way mm-hmm. of us accessing that. So just a reminder, you know, another monk, you know, when I was studying, he said, everyone should walk around with t-shirts that say you are that, like you are that, which you are seeking. You are that wholesome, that love, that happiness. It's already like, if you think of yourself as an infant or a toddler, you're inherently happy, right? In adulthood and teen and tweenhood, we built up all this shit. So just reminding people that, you know, it's already there through all the darkness and the ups and downs, like it's always with you. Yeah.
Okay. There's a couple stories in your history of receiving letters, yeah. and handwritten notes. Is there a note or a letter that either you've written or that you've received that like particularly stands out to you?
Oh my gosh. Okay. I don't know how you discovered that, but yeah, when I was in California, because I unplugged, I told all my friends and family, I'm like, if you want to get a hold of me, write me a letter. At this point, no one was fucking writing letters. But I sent and received 150 letters that year. And I don't, you know, I still have my box of letters from California, and you're inspiring me to go, you know, look at them again. But, you know, I got so much love and support, even though people like said I was crazy, because at the time it's like, it was an economic downturn and we sold our house mm-hmm. and left our flourishing careers. And people are like, what are you? It's economic crisis. What are you doing? But I got so much love and encouragement, even if it was just a little card. And I can't believe how many people wrote me. So I think just the encouragement, cause you know, there were tough times there and I'm like, what am I doing? And, you know, but all of that really helped me to stay grounded and continue to like, you know, believe in my passion and what I was doing. So it was a kind of a combination of them all, but good question.
All right. I'm trying to get back into like the pen pal game. So you'll have to send me your address. We'll get you a letter.
I'll write you one back.
All right, perfect. My last question for you. So I end every show with the sign off of stay weird. So Nina, what makes you weird?
That I have seldom conformed to the path, and, you know, call it weird, call it whatever you want. But even, you know, before it was practical, I'm like, I am doing this. And I think it's because of all the law, you know, I lost my dad and brother at 16. I lost my mom at 33. And I think that has made me really appreciate life, live life to the edge, and really lit like every day. I'm like, I could go tomorrow. So in a way it makes me weird, because there's a practical side of me, and my partner drives him crazy because so many times I throw it out the window. Cause I'm like, well, we could go tomorrow, you know? And yeah, people think I'm, when I went to California, everyone thought I was totally off the charts crazy. Like, you're going to live in an ashram, like when you have all of this established. So yeah, I think the weird part of me is just that, you know, I almost to a fault just jump in to what feels right without thinking too much about the practical.
That is a wrap on this week's episode of Destination Different. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you to Nina for coming on this week's show, for chatting with me, for taking the time out of her busy schedule to come and share her story on Destination Different. I love everything about her. I love her book. I love her approach to making mindfulness and meditation attainable to everyone. I love her attitude, her personality. She's been through so, so much in her life. And for her to still have just this bubbly spirit is just so impressive and so infectious. And it was just such a treat to get the chance to chat with her. So we'll make sure we get everything linked up of hers in the description of the show. But if you haven't already, go over to Amazon, go over to Barnes & Noble and get yourself her book, Let That Shit Go. And now, one more time, for the final time, I ask you, 2 seconds, 280 characters, write me a love letter. Please help me win this podcast contest. Please, 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 from the bottom of my heart. I really think that this show can win this thing. And all it takes is some of the listeners writing love letters, 280 characters. It's nothing. It's nothing. Please take 2 seconds to go and write a love letter right now. The contest ends March 4th, so the time is running out. Go and do it right now. That's it. We'll be back again next Thursday. Hopefully, podcast winners' love letters are in. We'll be back next Thursday with another episode of Destination Different. Until then, stay weird.
Superpowers. We fell in love for just a couple hours. I can't tell the difference between what's fake and what's been missing. Often I'm misunderstood, so I'm looking for a better me. This is your love song, baby. I hope that you know the world.